Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Republican National Convention begins today in Milwaukee. But on Saturday, there was an assassination attempt on the GOP's presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. It happened at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, shortly after Trump began speaking. One person was killed, two bystanders were injured, along with the former president, and the shooter was also killed by federal officers. Details are still emerging about the shooter and his motives, but one thing is certain: this incident raised the temperature of our political conversations. And although people on both sides of the aisle condemned what happened on Saturday and called for political rhetoric to cool, it remains to be seen if that will happen. And the Republican National Convention will be the first test of that. On this Politics Monday, we take a look at the political party that is set to nominate Donald Trump for the third time in a row, at how Trump and Trumpism have taken over the party, at the Republican platform and something called Project 2025, and at Trump's vice presidential choices. Joining us to talk about all of that is Winthrop University professor of political science Scott Huffman. He's also the director of the University Center for Public Opinion and Policy Research and director of the Winthrop Poll. Jacob Neuheisel is associate professor of political science at the University of Buffalo, or the University at Buffalo College of Arts and Sciences, where he is an expert of political communication, campaigns, and the presidency. And here to set the scene for us for the convention in Milwaukee and to give us some perspective from the Badger State is Sean Johnson, state capitol reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So Saturday's assassination attempt is not the topic of today's program, but it will undoubtedly inform both the convention and the campaign ahead, and the Democratic convention in August as well. President Biden, of course, spoke briefly at the White House on Saturday, and then again Saturday evening from the Oval Office. He made a brief address. He said that the First Lady and he were praying for Donald Trump and has extended his deepest condolences to the family of the spectator who was killed. And he called for unity.
There's no place in America for this kind of violence, or any violence for that matter. An assassination attempt is contrary to everything we stand for as a nation, everything. It's not who we are as a nation. It's not America. And we cannot allow this to happen. Unity is the most elusive goal of all, but nothing is important than that right now. Unity.
Scott, unity. Donald Trump also called for unity in the aftermath of the shooting. As a pollster, is unity something that can be achieved after years of deep divisions and two political conventions that are about to unfold, during which those divisions will likely be highlighted?
No. Next. to expand further, calls for unity from, you know, the leaders of the movement are expected at a time like this. There's nothing new from them, but the polarization that has been expanding, certainly since the 60s, and just gotten worse. Again, we can call it, you know, the gerrymandering effect. There's a whole lot of issues that have led to the polarization, but that has led to a society where people don't view their own side as the progenitors of the best ideas for America. They view the other side as a existential threat to the country and to their belief system. It's bad guys you want to get rid of. It's not the good guys you want to put in office.
In that clip that we just played, Jacob, of President Biden, he said that what happened on Saturday is not who we are as a nation. And yet shootings occur in this nation, multiple shootings, every single day now, it seems. And we have witnessed political assassinations in the not too distant past. I've been through several of them in my lifetime. Of course, Biden is not alone in saying these things don't represent us as a nation. But are those who say those things correct? Or is this who we are?
I think it would be correct to say it's not who we want to be, but it's absolutely in many ways who we are. And it's, you're right, it's not all that distant in terms of our past with the respect to political violence. And, arguably some of the worst violence the country's been through has been political in nature, American Civil War and the sort of terroristic acts that followed in the immediate aftermath through much of Reconstruction. You don't even have to go that far back to find instances of political violence. So it is something that the United States has dealt with. And to say it's not who we are is not quite accurate. Maybe who we don't want to be would be better to say.
And we've also had situations where J.D. Vance, for instance, one of the vice presidential possibilities that Trump may name, blamed President Biden for this because President Biden has called Donald Trump an existential threat to democracy. How do we get past that? Because the Democrats do view him as an existential threat, and there is reason for that belief. I'm not sure which one of the political scientists to ask that question of, but Scott, I'll throw it in your direction.
Sure. There's a difference between saying an existential threat to democracy and an existential threat to my core belief system. So Christian nationalists believe that the Democrats and the QAnon people believe that the Democrats actually have pedophile rings under the national parks. But the Republicans, the Trump supporters, and the Christian nationalists think that the Democrats are out to remove Christ, who should be at the top of the nation, whereas the Democrats are afraid the Republicans are an existential threat to our political system, not to our religious and life.
Jacob, I don't think there's any evidence that the Democrats are out to remove Christ. I think they're out to preserve the separation of church and state, and the Democrats view the Republicans as being almost fascist and willing to subvert democracy to these white Christian nationalist principles. Who's right?
I think a way to approach this would be to say that there's an existence proof no matter where you want to look, right? You can, if you're on the right, you can hold up, some example of a far left individual and say, look at this really divisive rhetoric, look at what they're saying. Obviously, it's deeper than just policy disagreement. They don't like us. They don't want us to have a seat at the table. And then it's perhaps a lot easier to find similar kinds of examples on the political right. I don't mean to both sidesism this kind of thing. I don't want to say, and I don't think that's empirical support to say that there's bad actors on all sides. I think the locus of this is largely on the right, but there's enough out there for both sides to hold up bad actors and say, look at this, this is what they want. And because we're really bad at thinking about averages, because we're really bad at thinking about what the modal individual within each camp looks like, we can use that to paint the other side with a very broad brush. So, I don't see this getting any better to go back to a question that you asked, Scott. As long as we're able to, hold these exemplars up and we're really bad at thinking about what the total picture looks like, I don't see much of a way out.
Scott.
I want to piggyback on that and say, in addition to that, or on top of that, that's a great example that Jacob's giving of how people simply will not believe evidence that counters their own belief system. We in political science have done experiments on this where people are presented with evidence that goes against their belief system. One piece of evidence, two pieces of evidence, up to five pieces of evidence. And in fact, the more evidence they get disproving their original view, the stronger their belief in the original view gets. And that is empirically proven. So we are talking about entirely different things and almost physically cannot believe the other side, whether they're presenting evidence or not. And both sides are guilty of logical fallacies, but that's a whole other show.
Let me bring Sean Johnson.
Heck of a drug.
Let me bring Sean Johnson into this conversation. He's a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Of course, the Republican convention begins in Milwaukee today. Those of us who were around Charlotte for the Democratic National Convention many years ago know what that looks like on the ground and what they do to the city on the ground and how they rope it off and tie it off. And there are policemen from every place in the country, or there were here. I'm sure the same is true in Milwaukee. On Saturday, law enforcement officials, I understand, Sean, in Milwaukee, began to tighten the cordon around your convention center there because of what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania. What will they be doing? What have they done to that part of Milwaukee to make it safer?
I would just say that, first of all, independent of what happened Saturday, Milwaukee was going to be and is a fortress downtown right now. And it just feels like the most fitting term when you look at a national convention. And this was true the last in-person convention I went to in 2016. They put this 8-foot-tall fence, miles of it, around the city. And, you know, there's limited access points to get in there. To get into those access points, you need to have a variety of credentials. You know, in a reporter's case, you have one that's issued by the Secret Service, which means you've gone through a criminal background check. Then you've got another set of credentials that lets you get into the perimeter, another set that lets you get into the arena where the convention is happening. You don't necessarily have all of them. And there are police all over the place. I mean, everywhere. Security barricades. It is, I use the word again, fortress comes to mind because it feels that way. And so just having walked around Milwaukee downtown last night for a bit, it's, you know, there's just a it's like a labyrinth of fence running through the city. Where you'll just be going down a street and suddenly you're cut off and, you know, better find another route. As far as what they do beyond that, you know, it's already so much, it's already quite a bit. And so whether or not the tests that you have to go through or anything like that to get around are more intensive, we'll see. But I can tell you that the law enforcement presence and just the security perimeter is kind of breathtaking.
Yeah. And you failed to mention the other pass level. That's the one that gets reporters down on the convention floor. I covered the Democratic convention in San Francisco 150 years ago. And I know that as a statewide reporter, I had to go and get credentials at the Moscone Center, which was a 15-minute walk from where our station was located. And then you had a 15-minute walk to the floor, which gave you 15 minutes to be on the floor because you had to walk that pass back, because if you didn't get it back exactly on time, you couldn't get it the next time you wanted to get it. So they make it really difficult for non-network reporters to have access to the floor. This is a Democratic city, Milwaukee, just as Charlotte is fundamentally Democratic, and you're hosting the Republican National Convention. Given what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania, does this put a lot of pressure on your city to make sure nothing goes wrong?
I would say that the events of Saturday put a lot of pressure on everybody in different ways, right? And so certainly Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, will be feeling that pressure. We do have an organized protest here, which was organized and in the works for months. You know, they have a speaking program. It's almost like a counter programming to the convention. It's not just people who showed up at the town square with signs and chanted. This is extremely organized. It is, you know, like a little convention outside the convention. But they have been in talks, negotiations with the city with regard to what police will allow and what they won't allow, where the debate or where the parade route for the protests can go. And so, yes, there's pressure, but like everybody in this group is kind of at the table in terms of talking about what that's going to look like.
Sean Johnson is a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. He's with us for the hour, along with Scott Huffman from Winthrop University and Jacob Nyheisel, who is an associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. We will continue our conversation about the GOP convention and more in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Scott Huffman, professor of political science and director of the Center for Public Opinion and Research at the Winthrop University. Jacob Nyheisel is an associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. And Sean Johnson is a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the opening of the Republican National Convention later today in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the shadow of a highly unfortunate assassination attempt on the life of President Trump, former President Trump, on Saturday. Again, yesterday morning, President Biden, after speaking in the Situation Room with key members of his national security staff, outlined how the government would be approaching its investigation into this incident.
As this investigation continues, here's what we're going to do. First, Mr. Trump is a former president and nominee of the Republican Party, already receives a heightened level of security. And I've been consistent in my direction of the Secret Service to provide him with every resource, capability, and protective measure necessary to ensure his continued safety. Second, I've directed the head of the Secret Service to review all security measures for the Republican National Convention, which is scheduled to start tomorrow. And third, I've directed an independent review of the national security at yesterday's rally to assess exactly what happened. And we'll share the results of that independent review with the American people as well.
Of course, what we know may change over time, but federal officials tell us that the shooter used an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle to carry out the attack. Earlier, GOP platforms outlined the importance of gun rights, and it condemned Democrats for proposing laws that would eviscerate the Second Amendment. This year's platform mentions gun rights only in passing, when listing a series of seven promises that they intend to accomplish quickly if elected. The seventh promise says Republicans will, quote, defend our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and our fundamental freedoms, including freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and the right to keep and bear arms. That's all it says. Meanwhile, the Heritage Foundation produced Project 2025, which was designed by key members of both Trump's past staff and his current advising staff, among other people, which continues to oppose gun control measures, arguing that they do not address the root causes of gun violence and would infringe on constitutional rights. So, Jacob, is that likely to change because of what happened on Saturday? Are there views of gun rights going to change?
I really don't think so. While it is true that we've seen some successful pushes for gun control in the wake of other kinds of assassination attempts or assassinations, JFK in particular, I just don't think that the Republican Party and their supporters are in a place where that's something that they can push or move on in the least. So they're not going to view this as a gun control issue. They're going to view this as something else fundamentally.
And we've already heard, Sean, from at least one Republican that the gun didn't fire at. I mean, the gun did not fire at President Trump. The shooter fired at President Trump. So I don't know if you can answer this question, and I don't know how close you've been to the Republicans gathered there for the convention. And I know some of them weren't even there this weekend yet. But are there discussions going on about gun control among the Republicans gathered there?
So I can give you just kind of the anecdotal interviews that we conducted yesterday at Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't want to insult the political scientists by drawing too much out of them. It's not a large sample size. We didn't apply math to it here, but I can tell you that the people we talked to were not raising that concern. I think you heard, by and large, we're not going to let this disrupt our lives was one theme that you heard from the delegates. Another theme you heard from delegates was, we feel very safe here. We trust law enforcement to do their jobs, and we think we're going to be fine. I think if you, the only dissenting voice that we heard, again, this is just our staff going out and talking to people yesterday, was somebody who is not there to participate in the convention, but somebody who worked at a nearby hotel who said, look, I'm glad that we have all the security. I feel pretty good about it. I just worry about people, whether we can kind of peacefully coexist. Politics tends to bring out the worst in people. So those discussions are happening in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, for sure. I'm not sure they're happening among the Republicans who've gathered for the convention.
Federal security officials have told us, Sean, that the threats against political figures have increased dramatically since this assassination attempt on Saturday. And I know you described Milwaukee as a fortress, and I'm sure it's more of one this morning than it was on Friday morning because of what happened. And it's very difficult to get close to any key political figures today, given the Secret Service protection and other protections afforded to them. But it happened on Saturday. Are there any fears that there are any holes in the security apparatus at in Milwaukee?
None, you know, none expressed to us certainly by Republicans. You know, I think everybody's probably looking at security differently today than they were a couple days ago. So, you know, that's a question that each person at this convention would probably answer differently if you got down to it. But in terms of the organizers, not a hint of doubt. In fact, they describe it as probably the safest place on earth right now. You know, because of all the police here and all the security precautions, it is security is top of mind for everybody working at this place right now. So it really is, you know, it's not something that's going to go overlooked in this environment.
Scott, Democrats and others have made the argument that taking military style weapons designed to kill as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, out of the hands of civilians would not infringe on a person's right to bear arms, because those weapons that we're talking about, like the one used on Saturday, are designed simply to kill people. They're not designed for hunting or even protection, it seems to me. But that's a distinction that is lost on many of the supporters of the Second Amendment. Knowing what you know as a pollster, is this incident likely to change any minds?
Well, you know, first off, no, it's not. And to go back on what you said about the weapons, in the early 20th century, weapons were banned on the basis of, oh, this is not a militia weapon. So the Supreme Court, for example, deemed sawed-off shotguns as you can ban them because they're not a militia weapon. Well, this Supreme Court would easily continue to allow things like AR-15s to be produced. And the polls back that up. Republicans see two things in the polls. Number one, and this has been alluded to before, number one, that mass shootings are the problem of deranged individuals, and there's nothing that could be done to stop a mass shooting because you don't know where it's going to happen. You don't know where a deranged individual is going to be. The other thing that polls show that Republicans believe about gun control is that crime would not be affected by gun control. In fact, it would be made worse because the only people who would be prevented from getting guns in their minds are legal, law-abiding citizens, and the criminals could still get illegal guns and continue to commit crime. So those are the fundamental beliefs for Republicans on the Second Amendment, according to the polls. And I'm about to go in the field with a poll of the 11 states of the South, and I guarantee you that it's going to remain the same. This shooting will not alter either of those fundamental views of Republicans about gun control.
Jacob, after what happened on Saturday, the media reported that those working on the convention were working hard to reframe many of the speeches that were scheduled to be made, I guess, in terms of tenor and perhaps in terms of topic and the words used. If that is true, I have yet to hear what sort of approach those speeches are likely to take. And there is some question. I read an article this morning in the paper where a columnist was wondering which Donald Trump would show up at this convention as a result of what happened to him personally. But from a political scientist's point of view, what should be the approach of these speeches and this convention?
That's a really good question. You know, there's the part of me that might be able to channel some kind of political strategist. And then there's the part of me who is a political scientist who is deeply concerned about worsening polarization and other kinds of things that I have the luxury of being concerned with because I don't, you know, work for a political party. But I think with the political strategist hat on, you know, the Donald Trump who's more likely to show up is the Donald Trump who had his fist in the air, blood on his face, saying, I believe, and if I was reading the correctly, fight. So I think that is probably more likely what we're going to see. And they're just going to have a lot more eyeballs on this than they were otherwise going to have. And so I think that they're going to likely seize that opportunity. And even though everyone's talking about taking the temperature in the room down a bit, I don't know that that's likely to redound to their benefit in terms of mobilizing people and getting them out. So, you know, from the political strategy perspective, I think that's probably more likely what we're going to see.
When John Hinckley shot at President Reagan, President Reagan's poll numbers shot up. They went higher. As of yesterday at 4 p.m., 538.com had Donald Trump ahead of Joe Biden in almost all of the polls nationally by 2 to 4 points, most within the margin of error. Certainly Saturday's assassination attempt will galvanize Republican supporters and strengthen their resolve to vote for the former president. But will it have any effect on undecided voters, Scott, as the pollster in the room?
Well, I think you were, what you pointed out was the key thing to remember, that a poll that's within the margin of error means pretty much nothing. And a single poll, unless it's one of my single polls, a single poll means absolutely nothing. Trends are what matter. So when we look across, what's happening nationally, if Trump has been up 1 or 2 points, that really doesn't mean much. But also, national polling doesn't mean that much either. National polling has been dead on for the past couple of elections, you know, predicting who would get more votes. You know, it predicted almost literally exactly how many, you know, what percentage of the votes Hillary Clinton would get. But that's not how we elect folks. In fact, I would argue Milwaukee was picked because Wisconsin is one of the blue wall states that the Republicans need to flip. And this is also my prediction of why J.D. Vance would be a good pick to go for the working class folks in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But a single poll really doesn't say much. What we need to look at is what are the trends? And people are going to, in this 24-hour news cycle, the Republicans are going to continue, the Matt Gaetz's, Marjorie Taylor Greens are going to continue to keep this out there. And here's where it will make a difference. It's not in the shifting of undecideds, because they're still going to see it as somebody they may see as unhinged versus somebody they see as way too old to hold the presidency. What it's going to do is increase Republican turnout by a point or two. It's going to galvanize the Republicans. And that's where this incident could have the most difference in the higher turnout among Republicans, as well as the malaise of Democrats because of what's going on in Israel. You combine those two, and that's what makes this dangerous for Democrats. And you can't call anything where somebody was murdered a good happening, but as far as polls go, helpful for Trump.
Sean, as of yesterday, as I mentioned, 538 had Trump ahead in most of those polls. He was ahead in Wisconsin at one point. Wisconsin is, as Scott just pointed out, one of those must-win blue wall states for President Biden. That we have the candidacy of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Going on. That's said to be possibly siphoning votes from one candidate of the other, probably Biden. And yet your state is a union state. And we have the president who was the first president to ever walk a picket line for the UAW, et cetera. What's the mood of Wisconsin blue state voters?
I think we've adopted the purple state mantra just because of how close it's been. While we have typically, aside from 2016, gone to Democrats in these presidential elections, four of the last six presidential elections in Wisconsin have been decided by less than a percentage point. So we're talking about in a state of where around 3 million people vote, give or take. The last two presidential races were decided by around 20,000 votes. It's just, it's kind of crazy how long we have been as close as we are. And I think Scott mentioned turnout, and it feels like a cliche. We do these stories in the political press every election, like, is it going to come down to turnout? I really believe it in Wisconsin, though, because when you're talking about a difference of 20,000 votes either way that could swing the election, and because we're one of those key states, swing the presidency, turnout matters so much. And you did have at the beginning of this cycle, and certainly throughout the cycle, you've had a number of voters who didn't like either candidate, they said. As Trump was faring a little bit better than Biden in terms of approval, it was still negative approval ratings. We will have to see what this tumultuous month does to those numbers. But, you know, that if there's any, if there's certainly room for growth there in terms of how the people view these candidates, because so far this year, it's been very negatively.
Jacob Neuheisel is with us. He's with the University at Buffalo. He's a political scientist. And I'm old enough to remember when political conventions actually mattered, where there was drama and suspense and you didn't know who the candidate was going to be. And there were floor fights and behind the scenes, backroom, smoke-filled room fights, etc. These have become little more than four-day television shows, most of which were not on television because there was nothing to televise. This one may be different because of what happened on Saturday. So you have what happened on Saturday, plus the 4 days ahead of us. Will this political convention matter? Will it cause interest in politics or interest in Donald Trump and maybe even interest in Biden go up as the course over the next 2 months?
It's a great question. I think there will be more eyeballs on this one than there were otherwise going to be. Like you said, there little more these days than, you know, 4 day infomercials for the candidates that nobody really tunes into because, well, they're very scripted. And because of how media works, anything that goes off script is what's going to be in the news cycle. And so what these conventions try to avoid is the mess ups, right? The problems that they have. If things are going well, that's not necessarily a good news cycle for them. It's when something goes wrong that they get a bad one. So it doesn't really, you know, balance out in those ways. And we do think that overall, these things matter at the margins. There is something of a convention bump that is still detectable in the aggregate, but I think that they've been mattering less and less over time. This one perhaps being the exception. You know, I said in an interview a few weeks ago that debates don't matter all that much, and there's almost nothing that can happen in a debate that would be unrecoverable by either side. Well, the almost nothing happens. So yeah, I think we might be in a situation where this one might be more important than usual.
I'm going to have 10 seconds, Scott, but we had the debate. It was a disaster for the president. He's tried to repair that. Yesterday, he looked very presidential as he tried to massage the situation in Pennsylvania. Will that help him, the fact that he looked presidential?
He's going to have to continue to look like a real leader, look presidential, and not look like your lost grandpa in order for him to move ahead.
So when we come back, we'll look at the GOP platform as we know it, that's being hammered together in Milwaukee and more. Stay with us as Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Scott Huffman, political scientist, director of the Center for Public Opinion and Research at Winthrop University. Jacob Neuheisel is associate professor of political science at the University at Buffalo. And Sean Johnson is a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin, the state where the Republican National Convention begins in Milwaukee today. Political parties spell out their hopes and dreams, their desires, their principles in their party platform. How much stock, Scott, should we put in any of these efforts, Democrat or Republican? Do they end up being a roadmap for the next 4 years ahead should that party win, or do they just sit in a drawer someplace?
Well, the actual the platforms of the conventions sit in a drawer. I can show you in the 20th century Republican platforms that called for support for labor unions. Those things sit in a drawer. Now, and I know you're going to have a separate show on it, but Project 2025 is much more of a blueprint of what's going to happen if Trump wins. It's a total re-understanding of what the presidency is, and president is the head of the bureaucracy. So that's much more, but these, you know, the convention platforms usually don't make that much of a difference. However, they can, when the Democratic Party added a civil rights plank to its platform, you had Strom Thurmond and a whole bunch of other Southern Democrats stand up and walk out and run as Dixiecrats. So there are instances where things that happen in the platform can matter. Usually the written platform itself isn't really a predictor.
The 2020 election, the GOP platform, Jacob, used the party's, pretty much the party's 2016 platform, and both conservatives and moderates within the Republican Party were unhappy with it. They were dissatisfied, let's put it that way. Social conservatives wanted new language or on gender identity and late-term abortions in the platform. Moderates said were worried about the platform not appealing to suburban voters in the Republican coalition. This year's platform, as I understand it, softens the GOP stand on abortion, rejecting a national abortion ban and opting to support a state-by-state approach, which Donald Trump has talked about several times on the campaign trail. How's that going to sit with the majority of Republicans?
That's a great question. With the majority Republicans, not clear. With a very firmly entrenched, sizable minority within the party, perhaps not that well. That being said, the Republican Party has brought the culture of conservatives more victories than they, possibly could have imagined in terms of the Supreme Court. So I don't know that they're going to jump ship. They're a captive group, they're a captured group, and they tend to like Donald Trump on the whole, even with his moral failings and those kinds of things that they're perfectly capable of overlooking. So I don't know that the really active contingent of that core of the Republican Party is going to be very happy, but I don't think they're going to do anything else. They're not going to walk away for sure.
Well, let's talk about, Scott, that support for Donald Trump. The GOP has adopted Donald Trump's slogan. It's all over the convention center. Make America great again, his mantra. And they make a point of supporting the forgotten men and women of America. That's in the platform. It says we are a nation, quote, in serious decline. It also emphasizes we will be a nation based on truth, justice, and common sense. Also a quote. That is obviously a strike against woke liberalism, that last part, common sense. Will it resonate with anybody outside the party? And can a party that has nominated, or is going to nominate, a person with a criminal conviction for 34 felony counts, a party that can say they're for justice, can a party that's nominating a guy who lies every time he opens his mouth, a party that can say that they're for truth? Help me out here.
Well, one of the things that you have to look at is a couple of pieces of research I've been doing recently is how in migration in the United States is creating the opportunity to reach out to, as you said, those forgotten Americans. The rural counties are depopulating, but as they are depopulating, they are getting much, much more conservative. That doesn't matter what the Republican Party says, they are anti-democratic. And the cities have been getting
Stop for just a moment. When you say anti-democratic, you're talking small d?
No, big D. Anti-liberal. Okay. So I'm sorry. I should have clarified. But the cities are getting more and more democratic. So as you have urban growth, you're getting states that become more purple, but it's mainly urban voting. States that remain more rural are simply getting more and more conservative. And we see that in the South. We used to look at the South as the peripheral South and deep South. We now look at it as the stagnant South and the grow South. And the only exception to the grow South is South Carolina, which is a growth South state. But the way we're growing, it's conservatives from New Jersey moving down and retiring on our coast. So we are becoming more conservative. But other than that, that's the entire reason Georgia is now in play. That's the entire reason that North Carolina can be purple, is that folks are moving into the urban areas. But the forgotten America, these are the rural areas where folks are moving out, feel left behind, as you mentioned. And, and that's one of the reasons J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, can maybe reach out to these folks.
Jacob, the GOP platform, as I understand it, is written in Donald Trump's voice. It echoes many of his campaign themes. Among the statements that it makes is this, quote, America is now rocked by raging inflation, open borders, rampant crime, attacks on our children, and global conflict, chaos, and instability. Inflation, however, is declining. Crime is declining nationwide. The borders have largely been brought under control and would have been more brought under control had the bipartisan bill that was cobbled together by Democrats and Republicans and President Biden been passed by the Congress. It was not passed because Republicans were told by Donald Trump to defeat it, and so they did. Are any of those assertions that I just mentioned true?
Are they true? Yeah, I think the numbers would bear that out. I think the bigger question, though, is whether they're true enough for people. And I'm borrowing here from the language of, you know, academic rhetoricians, where I don't know that people see numbers like that in an unfiltered way. In fact, political scientists would suggest that they don't at all. The numbers themselves are filtered through a ton of different biases and a ton of different kind of perceptual lenses. And so whether those things are true enough to people, I think, is what's going to matter versus whether they're statistically true.
Well, forgotten Americans include people who are working class people. Sean, you live in a union part of the world. We do not. I'm curious as to how people who are employed in unions, and there are probably many in Wisconsin, feel about Republicans versus Democrats, Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, who walked a picket line. Do they feel left behind and forgotten?
I think certainly in the smaller communities of Wisconsin, in rural Wisconsin, you have the, you know, white working class voters are very strongly behind the president, based on, you know, everything we see from polling patterns, voting patterns in polling. In terms of organized labor in Wisconsin, they're strongly behind President Biden, for sure, no doubt about it. Organized labor, though, it carries weight in Wisconsin, but not to the degree that it did like 20 years ago, when we still had a General Motors plant in Janesville, for example, when our state employee union as their local employee union was much stronger than it is today, before Wisconsin Republicans kind of defanged public employee unions. So the organized labor, faction of Wisconsin politics still matters. It just has changed, though. And you do have rank and file union members who are willing to support Trump today in a way that, you know, you wouldn't imagine 20 years ago.
Sean, can I look at the leaders and that are speaking? Did you see on the list somebody who is representing the Teamsters? Because I quickly went through the list of who was presenting, and I saw somebody, and I couldn't tell if they were the president, a leader, a past leader. But I think that's maybe trying to siphon off some of that. Did you see that in there? And what would that mean?
I got to confess, I'm looking at a lot of schedules now, and I didn't see that specifically, so I feel like I can't comment on that.
Scott, with the rise in Trumpism, there has been a concurrent rise in white Christian nationalism, and the two may be interconnected, intertwined. And that idea of white Christian nationalism has not necessarily been rejected by Donald Trump. There are good people on both sides, I recall him saying after Charlottesville. Senator Josh Hawley just said last week that he identifies as a Christian nationalist. The GOP platform has this sentence in it with regard to vetting immigrants. Quote, Republicans will use existing federal law to keep foreign, Christian-hating communists and Marxists and socialists out of America. Those who join our country must love our country. We will use extreme vetting to ensure that jihadists and jihadist sympathizers are not admitted. How unusual is that kind of language in a political party platform in America?
Well, it's less unusual than you think, because that was part of the quote-unquote American Party, the Know-Nothings, who ended up coming into the Republican Party, which started off as disaffected Whigs, the Free Soilers, and folks who were anti-slavery. And if you read the platform of the Know-Nothings, they didn't want the dirty, horrible Catholics coming in, no matter where they were from. And they wanted, if you did come, you would have to have a 17-year space before you were allowed to vote. However, in the modern times, you're right. This is unprecedented. And when they say you have to love America, they mean Christian white America. And I made a very tactical error in that I scheduled myself to teach religion and politics next semester, not this semester. I should have taught it this semester, because Christian nationalism is a core of it. People believe that our nation was founded on Christianity. It was meant to be a haven for Christianity, and that, you know, we should be the city of hope, shining city of hope.
Scott, that is not true. Scott, that, as you know, that is not true. So where does that come from?
No, that's absolutely not true.
Is it a lack of instruction in the public schools? Where does that come from?
Well, Mike, it's because we don't have the Ten Commandments on the wall of the public school. No, it is absolutely, it's not true. It's not a fact that we were founded as a Christian nation. We were founded as a nation that was predominantly Christian leaning, a lot of deists, but more importantly, a nation where all religions would be safe. If you read Memorial and Remonstrance by James Madison, it makes that perfectly clear. That state endorsed religion was antithetical to the ideas of what ended up in the Constitution. So no, we were not founded as a Christian nation. We were founded as a nation where Christians and I think Muslims, as the Treaty of Tripoli called them, could be protected.
So we need to talk about the possible vice presidential choices before we run out of time. There was a rumor that Donald Trump was planning to announce his choice on Saturday. Of course, that didn't happen. The leading candidates for that position at the moment appear to be North Dakota Governor and businessman Doug Burgum, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, who has come up many times in this conversation, and South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. Scott? What does South Carolina Tim Scott bring to the ticket if he's chosen?
Tim Scott's not going to add much to African-American support for Donald Trump. And he's also not going to change the outcome of South Carolina. South Carolina on Saturday just went from, you know, winning by 15 to winning by 30. But it was already going to win. Marco Rubio might change some Hispanic vote. In Arizona, Biden only won by 0.3%. So Marco Rubio could help there. J.D. Vance could probably help in the blue wall states. Burgum is so boring, he wouldn't be there. Lee Stefanik, she's not going to flip New York. So, personally, I think it's going to come down to Vance and Rubio, but I could easily be wrong.
Jacob, you want to give us your predictions on who we might choose in the next couple of hours, couple of days?
Oh, I'm terrible at predictions, but I think what Scott went through is pretty much exactly how I see this. I don't think Scott's going to add much to the African-American vote. I do think Rubio could help in some discrete areas with Latinos who are moving a little bit in the Republican direction. At least, you know, some polling suggests that. And J.D. Vance solidifies a lot of the rural white vote. So, there's some bonuses to a couple of those candidates, but I don't know that a VP pick is fundamentally going to change the dictates of this race.
Several Republicans, among them J.D. Vance, have blamed what happened on Saturday in Pennsylvania on President Biden, inflaming tensions about Trump, calling him a threat to democracy. But Donald Trump's authoritarian tendencies, and those among many in the GOP, are that threat. I think it could be successfully argued. You co-edited a book about it, Presidential Leadership and the Trump Presidency, Executive Power and Democratic Government. Must the messaging on either or both sides change, even if there is truth in it, as a result of what happened on Saturday?
It's another situation where I have the luxury of putting on my political science hat. In this case, yeah, I think it does need to change. I think we need to cool down the temperature in the room, but I just don't see what happens. I get this question all the time. It's maybe the most asked question in terms of, you know, how do we get back from our polarized era? And, you know, there's not an easy answer to that. We get some looks into other polarized eras in American politics, and, you know, maybe the best outcome we can hope for is kind of a coalition of elites get together and say, this cannot persist. We have to, even though it might be in our best interest to just keep winning and keep mobilizing on these kinds of things, we need to dial it down. So I think that's it.
Jacob Neuheisel is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Buffalo. Scott Huffman, political science scientist and director of the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. And Sean Johnson, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you all.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.